Welcome to the CB Wallet Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Jared. Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we are going to talk about the greatest disasters in world history. What went wrong, how it went wrong, and whether it was our fault or God's fault.
Awesome, Phil. But remember, Phil, it's not our intention to make light of the sometimes quite substantial mortality rate to some of these disasters, is it, Phil?
No.
We're just interested in finding out what went wrong, and be honest with yourself, Phil, if it came on the news, I reckon you'd be interested, wouldn't you, you godless heathen?
I guzzle down breaking news, Phil, faster than you can pour pig's blood out of a bucket.
What are we wanging on about this week?
Carrie, the musical.
Pat Collins is here now with a review to tell us if this show's going to scare us right out of our $50 seats. What about it, Pat?
Well, Jen and Van, Stephen King's horror movie has been turned into a horror of a Broadway musical. The only thing terrifying about Carrie is that there's a second act. Carrie, you might remember, is the telekinetic teenage misfit who uses her paranormal powers to destroy the mean and rotten kids in her senior class. Do you believe these are high school kids? They look like gang members from outer space. The blonde in red is the leader of the pack plotting to do something unspeakable to Carrie on prom night. Poor Carrie. She's an outcast. She has a religious fanatic for a mother. The set is white formica and looks like a hospital kitchen. Worst of all is the abysmal score. A mix of sound-alike solos and third-rate rock numbers.
So baby, don't waste the moon. Now that the night is out.
The score was written by the men who collaborated on the music to fame. They must have been under a curse when they wrote numbers like this one, which could be called Prom Night of the Damned.
Oh, John, drive me wild. Don't just see the stars burning.
With its bizarro sets and costumes, Carrie the musical completely misses the point of Stephen King's story, which used an ordinary suburban high school for a night of murder, revenge, and terror. After a night with this musical, I know how those kids felt. Carrie is the worst idea yet for a musical. Stephen King's story depends on the kinds of special effects that can only be done in the movies. I kind of kept hoping that Cujo, the mad dog from another Stephen King book, would descend upon the stage and put all of us out of our misery. Ooh. And this, I think in all my years of reviewing, this is right up there in the top 10 of the worst musicals I have ever seen. How it even got this far is a major mystery to me.
Musicals, Phil. You a fan of musicals?
No.
I'm not either.
Absolute arse. I can't stand them. But apart from a few.
Well, let's start at the beginning, Phil. What musicals have you seen?
I've seen Oliver. I like that. But that's on the telly. I saw Joseph and His Amazing Dreamcoat. That was all right. I like that. I like early Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Who was the Joseph?
God, I don't know. Can't remember. It was a matinee. So probably the understudy.
Oh, gutted. Because that was a Philip Schofield.
This is pre-Philip Schofield. That's how long ago it was.
So it would have been Jason Donovan.
Oh, God, no. This is pre the era of theatre where they got a big name in to get you in the seats. This is just going to the theatre to see a show.
Oh, my God.
Like, I'm talking early secondary school.
So really, like, what, the mid-60s?
I think that's it on stage. I'm just not interested. I couldn't care less. First time I ever went out with Julie, within about a week of going out, she had tickets for Billy Elliot. And she's like, oh, look, I've got these tickets. Do you want to come? I was like, do I fuck? She's like, what do I want? What do I want to see the Miners Strike recreated as a musical? Do I fuck? We're still together, but it was touch and go for a while.
You know that people in this modern day and age, there's been a couple of studies out that said that people are having to hide their political opinions.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was like 40% in England and 60% in America said they were self-censoring. And one of my main things that I self-censor about is I can't stand Julie Walters. I can't stand her. She makes my skin crawl. And I've learned, like, in polite society, you can't say you don't like Julie Walters. People won't stand for it. It's like, the problem is with you, Phil. The problem is you don't like Julie Walters. So why don't you do the reading and work out why you don't like Julie Walters?
Do you need to go on a Julie Walters re-education course?
Yeah, exactly. I've seen loads, Phil. I've seen The Lion King.
And what? You've actually seen that on stage?
I saw it on stage, and people love The Lion King. I did not like The Lion King. Mm. They have all the costumes and everything, but the heads don't go over their heads because they've got to be able to sing and speak and act. So they have like a double head on top of their head. right? So you've got like a perfectly normal man singing about Africa, Arsene Wenger, right?
Did you just sing Arsene Wenger then?
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Arsene Wenger! And he's got the head of a lion on. And everyone said afterwards, right. It was amazing how, like, after a while, you just completely forgot about, like, it was a mask. And, like, it really felt like the singing was coming out of the mask. And I was like, at no point did I feel the singing was coming out of the mask. It always looked like a man singing with another man's head on his head. All the way through.
It's like Julie's dad said to us, do you want to come and see Warhorse? And I'm like, no, of course I don't want to come and see Warhorse. I don't want to see a bloke pushing around a puppet horse for emotion.
I can't suspend my disbelief. I cannot. And I find myself watching the puppeteers more than I do the actual puppet.
That's why it's better in a film, because they can do it with CGI and effects and it looks real.
Phantom of the Opera, I went to see. Very good.
Saw it recently during lockdown.
Phantom of the Opera spunks its best bit in the first 30 seconds, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. But it is very good, to be fair. I don't mind a bit. Andrew Lloyd Webber at his peak. I'll accept that.
And also, especially early Webber, it's so bonkers, you've got to go with it, isn't it? Like, fuck it, they're on roller skates, mate. Why not? They're all on fucking roller skates, mate. They're all cats, mate. No, actual cats. It's not a metaphor. So, Phil.
Yes.
Carrie the Musical. What was it?
It was a Broadway musical based on the novel by Stephen King that lost a gigantic amount of money, even by the standards of an industry that's quite used to losing gigantic amounts of money. This was a whopper.
When did it happen?
The curtain came up on May the 12th, 1988, and then came down again, for good, on May the 15th after only 5 performances.
That's shocking.
Love it.
That's 4 on a matinee, I suppose, isn't it? So they finished the week, bless them. It didn't trouble anybody after the weekend. How many people died?
No untimely deaths involved in this one, Phil, unless you count the death of quality musical theatre.
First things first, Phil, we've mentioned him a little bit. Who or what is this Stephen King? Some sort of author, is it?
He is, Phil. He is one of the most successful authors of all time and has been compared to Charles Dickens.
Bloody hell.
Mainly in the sense that they both write very, very thick books that you take on holiday with you and then leave in reception when you catch the plane home.
Definitely.
Cue the Wikipedia music.
Stephen Edwin King is an American author of horror, supernatural fiction, suspense, crime, science fiction, and fantasy novels. His books have sold more than 350 million copies worldwide, and many have been adapted into films, television series, miniseries, and comic books. King has published 61 novels, including 7 under the pen name Richard Bachman, and 5 non-fiction books. He has also written approximately 200 short stories, most of which have been published in book collections.
Ooh, that is a prolific man.
Almost like he just bashes them out. It doesn't feel like there's a great deal of quality control when it comes to Stephen King, because I wonder if there's anybody left on the planet who could have a quiet word and go, do you want to cut this down to 1,000 pages, Stephen? Is that possible? I don't know if anybody wants to read 3,000 pages about a man who turns into a balloon. Fact me, Phil. Give me some facts about the great man, Stephen King. What do you reckon?
He is in a band called Rock Bottom Remainders, which is made up of other successful writers.
Oh, nice.
And from 1992 to 2012, the band toured about once a year.
What do you reckon they mean by tour there?
Yeah.
The pubs and clubs of Maine.
Yeah. Somewhere central to where they all live.
Yeah.
The other members, Phil, have included Amy Tan.
Who?
Dave Berry.
Who?
Mitch Albom.
What?
Barbara Kingsover.
Right.
Matt Groening.
Oh, Simpsons.
And Ridley Pearson.
Not heard of many of those.
I've heard of one of them.
Matt Groening.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're in a band with Amy Tan, Dave Berry, Mitch Albom, Barbara Kingsover, Matt Groening and Ridley Pearson and Stephen King, who do you reckon they put first on the poster?
Dave Berry said, we play music as well as Metallica write novels. Here, Phil, is a clip of Stephen King singing Hey Little Girl by Dee Clark.
Hey little girl in the black silk scarf.
There's a man who, if he wasn't a successful author, would never even be allowed on that stage. They wouldn't even let him hire it out.
Fact me two times.
Frank Darabont purchased the rights to adapt King's 1982 novella Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption for $5,000. But the author never cashed the check. According to the Wall Street Journal, years after Shawshank came out, he got the check framed and sent it back to Frank Darabont with a note that said, in case you ever need bail money.
That anecdote is supposed to be sort of funny, isn't it? But actually, it comes across as a massive power play, doesn't it? Like, I don't need your fucking money, mate. Do you know what I mean?
It's not like a cheeky matey, or, you know, here's your 10p back framed for those crazy times. Who is Frank Darabont?
Frank Darabont directed The Shawshank Redemption.
Did he now?
Have you seen The Shawshank Redemption?
No.
Fact me three times.
The Dollar Baby, or Dollar Deal, is an arrangement where Stephen King grants permission to students and aspiring filmmakers, or even theatre producers,
God forbid,
to adapt one of his short stories for a single dollar.
That's nice of him.
It's nice of him, but oh, I bet the results are poor.
Fat me four times?
According to Forbes, Stephen King earns $40 million a year.
Fucking a year?
$39,991,000 more than you or I.
About that.
Yeah.
It does feel that if you're getting $40 million a year, you should have your own schools, shouldn't you? I mean, shouldn't you have your own hospital?
I'm not sure I'd want Stephen King in charge of a school or a hospital, seeing some of his output.
You wouldn't want to go to the Stephen King ward of the local cancer hospital. So that's Stephen King sorted, but what's Carrie? Carrie? What the hell is Carrie? Book, is it, Phil?
Book it is, Phil, yes. And not only that, it was Stephen King's first book, although he had published short horror stories previously in magazines. Magazines, Phil, with incredible titles like Startling Mystery Stories.
Fucking hell.
And Cemetery Dance.
Jesus!
His very first published work is a short story called The Glass Floor in 1967. And it's about a woman who falls off a ladder. I'm sure I saw that in a Benny Hill sketch once. And he got paid $35 for that. The first draft of Carrie was so awful that Mr. King threw it in the rubbish bin. But Tabitha, his wife, fished it out the bin, saw potential in it, and said to him, King, give this another go. It was then published on April the 5th, 1974, and went on to sell over 1 million copies in its first year alone. Nice one, Tabitha.
Tabitha King is a successful author in her own right.
No, is she?
She is, yeah. I can't imagine anything worse than being Tabitha King.
Yeah.
There is no success that Tabitha can have that's ever going to outshine what her husband does, is it?
Oh, she's always going to be Winston Churchill's son.
Do you know what I mean? Imagine being Winston Churchill's son. Anyone only ever wants to talk about your fat racist dad.
Carrie, Phil, is one of the most commonly banned books in schools in the US.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because of its depictions of violence, cursing, underage sex, and its pretty negative view of religion. Over the years, it has been banned in Nevada, Vermont, Iowa, New York, Pennsylvania, and North Dakota.
Sounds absolutely perfect for a Broadway musical, Phil.
Doesn't it just? But what's it all about, Phil?
The plot of Carrie, Phil, is a well-worn story as old as time. Boy meets girl, boy takes girl to the prom, girl gets pig's blood dumped all over her by a jealous rival, girl sets everyone else on fire. that's the plot of Carrie.
Timeless fable.
That's right. Stephen King's own website, which is aptly called stephenking.com, describes the novel thusly.
The story of misfit high school girl Carrie White, who gradually discovers that she has telekinetic powers, repressed by a domineering ultra-religious mother and tormented by her peers at school, her efforts to fit in lead to a dramatic confrontation during the senior prom.
Although I do prefer this synopsis from a user on Goodreads. All Carrie wants is to be normal. Instead, she's telekinetic, has a balls-on-nuts mum and a school full of bullies to deal with. Her peers are hideous, particularly Tommy, who sounds like one of those douchebags who wears sunglasses inside and has his wallet attached to his pants by a chain. His girlfriend sucks too, but she seems more like a product of horrible parenting and peer pressure. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I am going too easy on her. Anyway, Carrie burns them all alive. The novel, Philip Lucas, has been adapted into a movie 4 times. Count them. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right.
Once very well, and 3 other times very badly. Brian De Palma's 1976 adaptation is the most well-known and by far the best. It stars Sissy Spacek as Carrie, who's awesome. Piper Laurie as Mrs. White, who's arguably better. I think Piper Laurie's the best thing in
She's
Carrie.
Brilliant, yeah.
She's so bonkers and so, so watchable, so charismatic. And John Travolta, who stars as Billy, and a whole host of other character actors. There's lots of well-known people who are in teen movies throughout the 70s and 80s. So there's lots of, oh, it's that guy from that person. Oh, she was in Halloween all the way through it.
Very good 70s hair.
The hair in this film is awesome, isn't it?
Very Farrah Fawcett.
Part of me thinks that maybe she's not telekinetic, it's just the electricity in people's perms. Brian De Palma's movie was released on November the 3rd, 1976. And do you know what film? Became a huge critical and commercial success straight away. No slow burn. People loved it immediately. The film made over $33.8 million at the box office. And it was even nominated for 2 Oscars, Phil.
Wow.
2 Oscars, which is pretty good going for a film about killing your mum and then burning your school down. Yeah. What do you reckon? Yeah. The screenplay for De Palma's film was written by Lawrence D. Cohen, Phil. So when people started talking about making a Carrie musical, it did seem like a shoo-in to write it, and so they got him again. But that, Phil, may have been a mistake. So, Phil, you know all about Stephen King?
He's an author.
He's an author. You know all about Carrie the book? You know about Carrie the film, yes?
Yeah.
But what on earth was Carrie the musical?
Well, Phil, Carrie the musical was originally intended to feel something like the Alan Berg opera Lulu, which I don't know if you've heard of, but it was written during the 1930s. Now, this is a story of a young woman who goes from being a well-to-do mistress in Vienna to a London street prostitute. The Austrian journalist Karl Kraus described the character of Lulu as a woman who becomes the destroyer of all because everyone destroyed her. So you can kind of see what they were going for with Carrie the Musical.
So they've got sort of high ideals for it. They want it to be something that has a meaning. You can be as good as you want to be in your heart, but if life beats you down, it will beat evil into you.
Yeah.
And it seems like they had higher ideals for the musical than Stephen King did for the book, to be honest.
Now, Phil, the lyrics for this musical were written by Dean Pitchford, and the music was by a chap called Michael Gore. Now, you'd think that people with names like Pitchford and Gore would be well up on their horror, but they are probably best known for their work on that other great work of horrific fiction, Fame.
Fame? As in Fame, I want to live forever. As in I want to learn how to fly.
That's
Fame.
That's the one. Yes, they worked together on 3 songs for the Fame movie. Red Light, I Sing the Body Electric, and obviously the title song, Fame, which, as we all know, became a huge hit with the rumour going around my school that the woman who sang I Want to Live Forever committed suicide turns out to be absolute cobblers.
Oh, it always turns out, the best things always turn out to be bollocks,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah.
I know it seems mad that you get the guys who wrote Fame to do the Carrie musical, right? But I can see what they're going for, because it's like it's high school, it's kids, and I can see like the pitch, you know, they can sort of go, do you fancy doing a similar sort of thing but with a dark edge? And everybody wants to do something with a dark edge, don't they? It's interesting, like, having watched the musical, I think that's one of the main problems with it tonally, is that apart from the bit where she tries to kill everybody, you're essentially watching a version of Fame.
Yeah,
you're watching like body warmers, stockings, high kicks, the splits, you know, lots of kids like in big dance numbers all talking at the same time. It feels very Fame.
Yeah.
And I've got to tell you, I think it's a mistake.
Well, considering that in the first 5 minutes of the film, you've seen gratuitous nudity and this woman virtually screams the school down because of the sheer panic of having her first period and not knowing what it is.
Yeah.
It suggests that a kind of teeny, like, hey guys, what are we going to do now? Do you want to go and grab a soda? Strikes me as a bit of a strange juxtaposition, but there you go.
I mean, they must have sat down and gone, how are we going to write the you've just had your first period number? Because there has to be a, she's having a period. Like, how do you, what direction do you come from that from?
Someone who is too powerful has had a shit idea and nobody can stop him.
Yes, I think that's what it is.
But back to old Gore and Pitchfork. They had an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and a Grammy nomination for that song Fame in 1981. Okay. So, you know, what we're talking about here, Phil, it's not a lot of hacks writing this musical. Like you say, they kind of knew what they were going for. Big, mega crowd-pleasing musical theatre.
That's true, but I've always said this, Phil, don't tell me I haven't. Just because you can write songs about leg warmers and crop tops doesn't mean you can do horror now, does it, Phil?
It doesn't, Phil. You're absolutely bang on there. Who was the money behind this theatrical masterpiece slash awful, awful, terrible idea?
The show was originally, Phil, going to be produced by hardcore musical theatrical veteran Barry and Fran Weisler.
Nobody called Barry as a professional in anything.
No, Barry and Fran. The thing is, I like the idea that Barry and Fran, they were feared. Like, oh my God. Do you know that Barry and Fran were in the stalls? And Frederick Zollo.
Barry and Fran sound like the puppets, and Frederick Zollo sounds like the man controlling them who goes on stage and makes the money.
Zollo holds the strings, doesn't he, I think? But basically, Barry, Fran and Fred, and it does sound like the cast of Rainbow, they are big hitters in musical theatre, right? And if you know anything about musical theatre, which we don't, you'd have heard of them, right? Okay. That's like saying the Weinstein scenes, but in a less
in the early days.
In the early days, yes.
When presidents wanted to be filmed with him.
Yeah, in a less problematic sense. They were like the Weinsteins. They're big, powerful producers. But all the funding fell through. I imagine when they found out the first scene was about having a period.
Yeah, well, I think when they found out that they wanted to make a musical of Carrie, the funding fell through.
They said yes, and then they went, oh, that's Carrie. No, that's what happened. So instead, Phil, it was all fine because the funding was picked up by 39-year-old West German businessman Friedrich Kurtz.
Now, I'd imagine, Phil, this is a man very experienced.
No, Freddie had never produced a Broadway musical before.
Oof.
That's not 100% fair. He had done a version of Cats in Hamburg, which I imagine he'd called Katzen with an exclamation mark, probably. So he was half the funding, and the other half of the funding came from the theatre group itself, a theatre group who I think is pronounced as Jujamsen Theatres, but I'm open to being corrected, right?
Right.
Now, Jujamsen Theatres gave $500,000 towards the production, which would have been awesome, but that right. money did go mainly on refurbishing their own theatre.
Oh, clever.
After we've painted the walls and put all the new seats in, you can have as much one as you want. Carrie, the musical, was directed by Terry Hands, Phil.
Terry Hands!
Who I imagine in the trade was known as Terry Jazz Hands, and if yes. not, what an opportunity wasted, Phil.
Terry Jazz Hands. That's tremendous, Terry. I mean, Terry's a great name.
Terry's a great name for anybody. You only trust a Terry if he's turning wood. Don't you? I think.
I came across a bloke recently called Terry Manners. Oh, and I thought that was such a great name.
Terry Manners is a good name.
Like, keep your voices down, boys. We don't mind you having a bit of a kickabout, but it's 8 o'clock at night now. Some of us just want to relax. There's a Terry Manners. Yeah. He knows how to behave on the estate.
Terry ran the Royal Shakespeare Company for 13 years, Phil.
Right, okay.
He very sadly died this year in February, Phil, Terry Jazz Hands. He was 79.
All
he
right.
did loads and loads of other really good and successful things in his life and career, Terry, that were loads better than frickin' Carrie the Musical. So it seems a shame that we're remembering through his worst production ever. But we don't have time to go through all of these successes. And in a very real sense, it's not what the podcast is here for.
No, we don't care about the things that went well.
No, exactly. But rest in peace, Terry. Carrie herself was played by Lindsay Hatley,
right,
which must have been a gift for reviewers. How did I feel about Miss Hateley? Lindsay was 17 years old at the time of the musical. Now she's playing Carrie. I can't remember where Carrie's set. I don't think in the musical they actually say where it's set, but I imagine the book's set in Maine, America anyway.
Yeah.
So where do you reckon they sourced Carrie from?
Well, theatre school, so probably sort of somewhere New England, Boston area, that sort of thing.
Birmingham.
Oh!
Birmingham. The UK Birmingham, not the Alabama Birmingham.
Not even the Alabama one. She's from the one.
Yes, that's right.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes. I also want to say goodbye to all listeners from Birmingham.
I don't mind Birmingham. I don't mind it.
High praise indeed. She was basically unknown. Right. She was a Brummy actress, 17 years old, completely new from Birmingham. Right. But, Phil, they know they got to have star power.
Yeah.
Right? They're not idiots, right? Terry Jazzhands and Freddie the German, they're not idiots when it comes to casting their musical, right? Mm. They had Barbara Cook signed up to play Mrs. White.
Oh!
Have you heard of Barbara Cook?
No.
Barbara Cook, Phil, in musical theatre circles, is an absolute giant.
Oh, okay.
She's been in them all, Phil.
Right.
She's been in Oklahoma. Carousel.
Heard of that.
The King and I.
Heard of that.
Fanny. The Gay Life. She's an absolute pro, Phil. She's been in a more film. And she is also now sadly dead.
Oh.
So that's the background sorted, Mr. Phil Lucas. What the hell happened in Carrie the Musical?
The doomed production started its life on February the 13th, 1988, in the home of horror, Stratford-upon-Avon. Home of the other famous playwright, William Shakespeare. Yes. And that ran at the Royal Shakespeare Company for 4 weeks.
How fast do you think old Bill Shakespeare rotated in his grave? When they did Carrie the Musical at the RSC.
Oh, like a hog roast at a wedding. Now,
you could power Birmingham, I should imagine, just with... Seems to be a sound of drilling coming from Shakespeare's grave.
The critical reception, Phil, was absolutely rancid. But apparently the show was receiving standing ovations on many nights.
What?
Which, you know, just goes to show that fans of Shakespeare don't know what they're talking about. Now, Phil, Barbara Cook.
Yeah.
Now, she quit immediately after the opening night.
Is that bad luck in the theatre? They've got lots of weird rules in the theatre, haven't they? You can't say Macbeth.
Oh, yeah.
If your leading actor quits on the first night, you know, oh, you got to do a rhyme.
Now, she quit for 2 reasons, right, Phil? One, she's a pro.
Yep.
So she knew what was coming.
Yeah.
And secondly, she was very nearly decapitated by a section of the set for Mrs. White's living room.
Oh, wow.
Now, she was replaced by somebody who obviously wasn't too fussed about potentially being decapitated. A lady called Betty Buckley. She was the lady who played the gym teacher in the 1976 De Palma movie.
Oh, she's very good.
And despite the poor reviews, they all set off for the bright lights and the gold-paved streets of Broadway, USA. Now, Terry Jazzhands, yep, he's pretty excited about this, but he's an old pro. And he was not complacent about the giant leap to the US stage. He said, Phil...
See, Broadway is an exciting place, but it's like warfare, you know? Don't expect to go without a helmet on. You know you're taking your life in your hands.
God love him, Terry Jazzhands, R.I.P.
He knows that going to Broadway with a show about menstruation backed by a very dodgy German businessman is not the firmest footing to be going on. He knows.
Now, Phil, the show started previewing on April the 28th, 1988 at the Virginia Theatre on West 52nd Street in Midtown Manhattan.
Broadway, it's Broadway.
Nearly. Nearly Broadway.
Off Broadway, close to Broadway. You can see Broadway from here.
And it played to a mixture of both boos and standing ovations. So, Phil, what actually happens in Carrie the Musical?
Well, far too much, Phil, to go into too much detail. I mean, it is, after all, a 2-hour Broadway extravaganza about telekinesis, menstruation, bullying and pig murder.
And dirty pillows!
But, thankfully, instead of us having to sit through the whole bloody masterpiece ourselves, we're indebted to author Ken Mandelbaum.
Wow.
Now, Ken Mandelbaum has very helpfully laid the whole plot out in his book Not Since Carrie, 40 Years of Broadway Musical Flops.
Which you have on every format, don't you? You've got that hardback, softback, Kindle.
I've got it embroidered onto a duvet set. So here, Phil, is a very brief and incomplete overview of its intense, life-changing content. Are you ready, Phil?
Curtain up!
The lights come up on a dozen women, Phil, in togas.
Ooh.
Looking, says Mandelbaum, far too old for high school girls.
Always the way.
Now, these women are engaging in strenuous aerobic exercise, Phil.
I'm in.
Suddenly, a row of translucent revolving shower cubicles lift the girls into the air. They sing a song in what one reviewer called uncertain American accents while dancing in their underwear. Now, what we can't really get across in that stanza is just how long this opening number takes. It takes hours. And hours and hours. This shower scene goes on and on and on. Anyway, after 6 or 7 hours of dancing, Carrie White, wearing nothing but a towel, sings about her feelings of isolation and longing in a performance that Mandelbaum describes as
one of the most overwrought and lengthy solos ever in a Broadway musical.
The scene shifts to the White Home, which has been decked out with a wooden floor and a trapdoor. Okay. They've not put a lot of work into staging, right? There is a chair. Now, Mrs. White, she's on the chair, and she learns that Carrie's being bullied at school.
Mama, something terrible. Terrible things are the Lord's way of testing us, Carrie. No. But the other girls. You're not like the other girls.
I am, Mama. I am. I never thought so.
You're not, Carrie. You're special.
You're not listening to me, Mama.
I've heard all I want to hear.
But, Mama, in the shower.
You are forbidden to shower with the other girls.
I know, but, Mama, forbidden. I started to bleed.
Now, she interprets this as evidence of Carrie's evil, so she starts chasing her around the stage where they both sing an operatic duet called And Eve Was Wake. Suddenly, Margaret pushes Carrie down a trapdoor. Then the kids come back on stage, like in Fame, right? Start dancing around, but now they're wearing studded leather.
Ah, that's what theatre people think is hard.
They still think it's on the waterfront, right?
Yeah.
They're moving around in what Mandelbaum calls
a kind of neurotic disco.
Chris, who's a bad girl, right? Now, you can tell Chris is a bad girl because she's wearing a red body stocking, right? She starts to plot revenge on Carrie with help from our horrid boyfriend, Billy, who's John Travolta in the film, right? Meanwhile, good girl Sue, which you can tell she's a good girl because she's wearing a pink body stocking, right? She persuades her nice boyfriend Tommy to take Carrie to the prom. By now, says Mandelbaum, anyone unfamiliar with a Stephen King novel won't have the slightest idea what's going on. Or who the characters are, or even where the show is taking place. Next scene, Phil. Carrie informs her mother that she's been invited to the prom, triggering Mrs. White's lurid recollections of having sex in the song I Remember How Those Boys Could Dance.
I'm guessing dance is like I Remember Those Boys.
She means fucking, Phil.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Suddenly the stage floor opens and Carrie's hands burst into fire. End of act one.
When do her hands burst into fire in the film?
Don't think about it.
Okay.
People at this point are milling out to get their red wines and their ice creams were completely bewildered. Mainly, as Mandelbaum explains, because although Stephen King buffs know that Carrie has the power of telekinesis, Phil, it's never actually explained in the musical. People were just expected to know that Carrie was telekinetic. They never mentioned it, right? Which left many audience members going into the interval asking each other, why were Carrie's hands on fire? Anyway, forget all that, Phil. Not important. Move on. Act two. Curtain up. We open on a pig farm. Now. Billy slaughters some pigs. Remember Billy? He's John Travolta. He slaughters some pigs, right? Now, he's collecting blood. Why? No one knows. The audience is treated to recorded sounds of oinking throughout. At this point, the stage is all awash in red, right? As boys in leather sing the song Out for Blood.
Oh, leather, saying the word blood, dangerous.
Also, Phil, add into the mix the fact they're jumping over a flaming pig trough. Meanwhile, Billy, remember John Travolta from the film, now topless and with his hair in braids, is smearing pig's blood on his chest. Mendelbaum describes this scene thusly, Phil.
A nightmare from which no show could possibly recover.
Now we're at the prom, right?
Okay.
And a mirrored disco ball arrives for some reason on the floor rather than the ceiling. This is the moment where Carrie is going to be drenched in blood, right?
Yeah.
It is built up to the nth degree. It takes fucking ages. And I don't even remember the bit in the film, right? And in the book, it builds up. It's Hitchcockian,
yeah,
isn't it? It builds up. It's so clever. They got that one long scene up to the round, the following the rope up to the bucket and then down to the girl holding the bucket. An amazing scene in the Brian De Palma movie. Well, in Carrie the Musical, what they do is they distill all of that into a set piece that is so badly staged, it gets laughs from the audience rather than gasps. Basically, what happens is Billy just runs up and pours a small bucket of what Mendelbaum describes as raspberry topping all over Carrie's head. Like, it's the most nothing thing in the world. He literally just walks on and goes, whoop, there you go.
I got to say, I've watched this bit, because you can watch this musical on YouTube, and I watched this bit, and she has so little red dye on her.
Yeah.
And she's making such a fuss. It's on a little bit on her head.
Yeah.
And there's nothing on her clothes at all. It's terrible.
It's not the sort of incredible humiliation that would make you kill everyone you'd ever met, is it?
No. She needs to be doused in this stuff, and she's got a little bit on her head.
So, Carrie has been humiliated in front of her peers, right? So they're all going to laugh at a film. They're all going to laugh at you. Right. This is what we've been waiting for, Phil. We've been in the theatre for an hour and a half. The set for Mrs. White's house has basically been a chair. We know where the money's gone, Phil. It's gone in the devastation. Carrie killing everyone with their telekinetic powers, right?
Yes.
So what happens next? A chill goes over the audience. Carrie is lifted hydraulically onto a platform, extends her arms and shoots lasers into the audience.
Oh,
lasers, Phil! Jazz lasers into the audience!
Oh,
Mendelbaum
God.
Describes the terrifying scene of telekinetic destruction as follows, Phil.
What looks like a plastic shower curtain traps the revelers and they feign their death throes. A roof descends with a hole cut in it so that Carrie, still aloft, is not decapitated. And when the lights come up, the roof has become an enormous white staircase. Where are we? On the high school steps? In heaven? At Jacob's ladder? At Jacob's pillow?
Mrs. White, okay, now obviously in a cocktail dress, she comes down the steps singing a lullaby, takes out a knife and stabs Carrie in the chest. Don't know why I'm at your prom, but I'm here and I got a knife.
Yeah.
Carrie, in retaliation, lightly touches her mother on the chest and she falls down dead, Phil.
Well, that's not as good as in the film, is it?
No, not really. Carrie crawls backwards down the stairs, smearing blood as she goes, as the lights fade to black, leaving nothing but the corpse of her dead mother on the platform. Curtain down, Phil. The crowd goes wild in two very distinct ways.
Well, I'll be honest, Phil, that sounds amazing. It's got everything. It's got blood, it's got leather, it's got pigs, lasers, disco balls, what's not to like?
Reading it out, it does sound like it'd be amazing. But it's weird because watching it, you want it to be one of those things that's so awful, so schlock that it's amazing. But actually, it's almost not bad enough.
Right, yeah.
If it was much, much worse, it would be such a laugh.
Yeah, like when I went to see War of the Worlds, it was so bad, yeah.
Yeah, something so bad it's good. It has the potential, doesn't it, Carrie, to be so bad, so tonally weird, so over the top, that it would be incredible, like Rocky Horror, incredible. But actually, in the final analysis, what it comes out as is boring. One really, really bad review can fuck you, right? And the reviewer that really fucked Carrie the Musical was Frank Rich in the New York Times.
Right.
And actually, that review is not that much of a hatchet job. It's a pretty fair review, which is probably really what done it in for Carrie the Musical. They had to read it and go, well, fair enough. But he said, Phil, reviewing it after the first performance, that the disaster was not inevitable.
Right.
He said it's a workable idea for a musical. The director, Terry Jazz Hands, is a gifted theatre man. And as the film director Brian De Palma demonstrated, Carrie can make for scary, funny, sexy pulp entertainment film.
Mm.
So what was the problem with it, Phil?
I guess that many people probably weren't used to seeing a lot of pig's blood and menstruation on Broadway in 1988, and quite frankly, any time.
I suppose that's fair enough, isn't it?
I suppose you could say, if you're being generous, it was ahead of its time in that sense.
A good 60 or 70 years ahead of its time, probably.
Yeah. It's ahead of its time coming out as it did 12 years after the film. Or maybe the dark, sinister and tragic story of Carrie felt somewhat cheapened by the use of lasers, hydraulics and lyrics like, "It's a simple little gig, you just have to help me kill a pig."
Yeah, it's a good point.
In some ways, the story, it's kind of like an evil alter ego of the musical Grease, isn't it? It's like an alternative universe where Sandy stabs Danny in the throat and then burns Rydell High to the ground. And I don't know. People just probably weren't ready for that in 1988. I mean, that's being generous, you know.
I think it's true because, having watched it, it is bad. It's not... It doesn't have anything good in it.
It wasn't all bad, though, Phil.
No.
People were impressed with Hatley as Carrie,
yeah,
and Betty Buckley's performance as Mrs. White. Frank Rich said of her performance that although she
remains a misogynistic cartoon, she brings theatrical heat to every slap happy bout of corporal punishment and every masturbatory hand gesture.
Which does sound like damning with faint praise, to be honest, Phil. But even Stephen King was pleased.
I bet he was.
Yeah, he's got an evil streak, though, hasn't he? He said that he liked it for many of the same reasons why Frank Rich from New York Times didn't. Stephen King said,
"He and I saw the same show. We just drew different conclusions from different perspectives."
Which I think secretly means I just made literally millions from this. Any chance we can keep doing it?
I think it's fair enough, that, isn't it? Yeah.
And he's got an evil streak. He likes seeing rubbish.
I wonder if he's secretly happy that it's terrible. For a novelist, the worst thing could be, well, I'll tell you what, the musical was loads better than the book. You don't want that,
yeah,
do you?
Now, one of the main problems seems to have been inexperience, even with a talented writer and composer on board. Terry Jazans, the old director, he was quite open about this, even before the opening.
"I didn't know what I was getting into. I don't know anything about musicals. This is my first time. But all of us on the show have been incredibly, unbelievably inexperienced. Rarely have such inexperienced, but I suppose kind of naively enthusiastic people got together to try and make something. I'll tell you what it was like. It was like wrestling with a boa constrictor a lot of the time. It keeps coming at you and you think, oh, I don't know where to put my bloody feet."
Wow, so it was never really firm ground to begin with, was it? And, you know, if you add into this 7 years of delays, cast changes and false starts, and you've got the recipe for an absolutely gigantic musical theatre turd all over your jazz hands.
Well, sadly, because of the overwhelmingly negative reviews, Phil, especially the one in the New York Times, and despite full houses every night, to be fair, and even a number of standing ovations, apparently, old Freddie Kurtz panicked.
Oh.
It's his first gig on Broadway. He panicked, the spineless goon, and he pulled the plug.
Oh, what a snowflake.
Pulled it, Phil, after a week. Carrie closed after only 16 previews and only 5 proper performances.
Wow.
Losing, Phil, an absolutely whopping $8 million.
Wow.
Making it arguably the biggest flop in Broadway history.
Yes, that's what we like.
There are other flops, huge flops in Broadway history. There is The Moose Murders, which is very famous on Broadway for being one of the worst plays ever brought to the stage. Also, Spider-Man lost a titanic amount of money. But I think Carrie the Musical still arguably holds the record for losing the most amount of money.
Tremendous.
In the shortest amount of time.
Lovely.
Lindsay Hately, who played Carrie, was pretty upbeat after the show's closure. She said, Phil?
Well, I've played Broadway and hopefully I've made a good enough impression to do something even better in the future.
Now, it would be funny at this point to say, and she never acted again. But actually, she's had a pretty amazing career. She's been in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. She's played Nancy in Oliver! She's been Roxy Hart in Chicago, Winifred Banks in Mary Poppins, Donna in Mamma Mia! And she's been nominated for a frickin' Olivier Award, so we can't.
This is the thing though, Phil, isn't it? We slag these musicals off till the cows come home, but that's not to say that the actors in these things are not incredibly talented and amazing.
We have both used to have jobs where we stand on stage. And I've got to tell you, I stand on stage when I get work 20 minutes ago. And I tell you what, I am fucking knackered.
And you don't sing and dance, do you?
Don't sing and dance. If you're Roxy Hart in Chicago, you must be absolutely knackered when you come off that stage. Knackered, drenched in sweat. God, like, I bet you lose a stone. Like MC Hammer losing a stone every performance.
Yeah.
Poor old Terry Jazzhands, though, Phil, I'm afraid. He was a little bit more downhearted. He put his all into it, and I don't think it came off. He said after the closure, to be honest, I'm not sure I'm good enough. I've given it a damn good try. It's been like climbing the Eiger. There are safe ways of getting to the top of the Eiger, you know. Then there's the north face of the Eiger. At some point in your life, you think, hey, now I've got to try it. But, you know, maybe I'll take another route up the Eiger next time.
Oh, poor Sarah. I mean, if he's the director and he's comparing it to climbing the north face of the Eiger and wrestling a boa constrictor, then he is pretty downbeat. Oh, bless poor Terry Hands. I do hope, though, on his tombstone it says, here lies Terry Hands, director of Carrie the Musical.
I'll tell you what it says on its tombstone. It says, Carrie Whiteburn's in hell. So, Phil, that was the epic story of Carrie the Musical, one of, but probably not the absolute worst musicals of all time. Was it our fault or God's fault, Phil Lucas?
It was Stephen King's fault for not writing a horror novel that could be more easily set to music.
Definitely.
Perhaps it is finally time to write the Humbug Billy story.
Shitting glass. Shitting blood. So Phil, we've had some lovely, we've had some really nice reviews since we did the gin edition of Crash Bang Wallop. I'm pleased that people like the gin edition of the Crash Bang Wallop podcast, because to give it a bit of authenticity, I was drinking quite a lot of gin all the way through it, and by the last 15 minutes was roundly arseholed. But it seemed to get a good response. We got some lovely reviews though, didn't we, Phil?
We did. Very, very nice. Yes, we had Dustin Myself Off from the United States of America, and he said, hilarious, interesting and informative. The hosts are laugh out loud funny, and like all Americans, I find their accents endearing. They have an innate knack for walking right up to the edge of dark humour without crossing over. It's not a knack. If we have got it, it's pure luck, but thank you.
I'm actively trying to cross over now.
But he said, what sets this episode apart is the great hodgepodge of topics. Thank you very much. We do try and mix up the topics, so that's very, very kind of you to say so.
Kaloofle. Hello, Kaloofle. Says, great podcast, totally engaging and accessible, and I feel like I'm really learning things. Aww. Really, Kaloofle? Thank you for saying so. The podcasters pick excellent topics, and the research that goes into each show is commendable. He's talking about you there, Mr. Kaloofle.
Thank you very much.
He doesn't say the waffle over the top is also good. That's my end. It can be a bit harsh to share the new knowledge, though, he says. Yesterday, at a level crossing, I tried to tell my family about the 1915 Quinter's Hill rail disaster and was asked to stop. Which has made me very happy, Kaloofle. Thank you very much.
I like that. Oh, another one from this time further abroad, from Australia. Thank you. Heave Hojo says, please write that musical. We've got to do it. We've got to do it. Discovered this gem of a podcast courtesy of an offhand remark from Angela Barnes of We Are History. Love the guys. They make me laugh. And yes, teach me a little. It's a small smile in these uncertain times. Bravo, gents. Oh, thank you so much. That's really, really lovely of you. And lovely that you listen to Angela Barnes. We Are History. We love Angela and we love We Are History. It's a great podcast, so you should listen to that one. If you're good people, if you're good yes. people. No, it's a great podcast. I find that one really interesting myself.
Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Band Wallop podcast. Again, we'll be back as soon as we can with another tale of disgusting murder and woe. Philip, what are you going to do with the rest of your Saturday night?
I'm going to take a damp towel to my forehead, and then I'm going to start writing Shitting Blood.
Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Band Wallop podcast this week. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.